Hey, Bon Appetit Foodcast, and I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we have on contributing wine writer Marissa A. Ross. Been a while since Marissa has joined us, and she's talking about a big piece she wrote for our September issue of Bon App about all the things she is most excited about and maybe a few things she's done with for fall when it comes to the world of wine. After that, I sit down with Carla Lolly Music to talk about a very favorite late summer produce, corn. We tell you how to buy the good ears, how to prep them, and of course, how to cook with them. And there's a lot of talk about butter. But before we start, I just want to thank all the listeners who have subscribed to Bon Appetit, the magazine. So many of the recipes we talk about on the show and the articles and the ideas start with the magazine, and it allows us to do what we do. So if you want to subscribe, that would be hugely appreciated. You can go to bonappetit.com/get the mag. That is bonappetit.com/get the mag, and you get a year subscription for like 10 bucks, and of course you get a tote bag with that. Finally, quick note, Marissa being Marissa, there are a few curse words in the wine segment. So if you got your kids with you, put their earmuffs on. All right, here's Marissa A. Ross talking wine. Marissa A. Ross, welcome to New York.
Thank you. It's nice to see you, Adam Rappaport.
What'd you get up to last night?
Last night I drank a lot of wine at Pinch Chinese.
I've been to Pinch Chinese. Talk about, I like that restaurant and I like their wine list. Could you explain what they got going on there?
Yeah, definitely. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a food writer, so I'm probably like the last person that should be talking about, the food at Pinch, but I can tell you that it's really awesome Chinese food. Incredible soup dumplings.
It's in Soho, slick little like narrow space.
Totally. Yeah. And they have a great wine list. A ton of natural wines. Miguel, who does the wine there, is a friend of mine, and I met him on my trip to Greece that I was just on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, and we became buds there, and so I wanted to go and like check out the restaurant, and then before that I was at Cafe Altro Paradiso for like 4.5 hours, like the longest lunch of my life, but also the best.
See, I can't do that. I don't have that stamina that you have. Like, if I day drink, I'm done. I can have like a couple of like Bud Lights and aluminum bottles, and like that's like my limit for day drinking. Otherwise, it's like I'm either gonna day drink and not go out, or if I'm gonna go out, I have got to really pace myself.
So here's the thing, and I tell this to everyone: it's all about maintaining when you're day drinking.
What does that mean?
Basically, what I like to do is you don't drink a lot. You just drink just like a straight line. Like, just you never get drunk, but never get sober. You just kind of stay buzzed. And that's the only way to do it.
That's my problem. I'm a kind of a fast out the gate sort of guy.
Exactly. That's the problem. And you got to be
slow. I get very
slow.
Excited. I'm like, ooh, I'm drinking. And then all of a sudden I'm like, clunk.
Yep.
Okay. So you have a new piece in our September issue, kind of like your fall preview, what you're stoked about for the several months ahead. We're going to run through it in no particular order and get your thoughts on everything from bottles to glasses to regions. First up, apparently we're not allowed to use the word funky anymore.
Yeah, I'm over it, you guys. It's really, I'm done with funky. It's been overused to death.
Well, overused in particular, for particular wine people, you're big into the natural wine thing, and I think that's where it gets used ad nauseum.
Yeah, exactly. And it no longer has a meaning. Like, once upon a time, you could say something was funky, and maybe it would mean, oh, like it's like funky as in like Sly and the Family Stone, or it's funky, like, you know, I don't know. But now it's sort of a catch-all descriptor that can mean that you don't like it or you do like it. Like, I've heard people, I was at Friedman's in Los Angeles, which was a part of the September issue last year.
Yeah, our Hot 10 issue. Yep. It was the cover. It was that cool, basically a potato latke in a waffle iron with the smoked fish on top.
It's so amazing. Yeah. I love that dish. It's one of my favorite dishes. But I was there, and there was a customer that wanted to talk to me about the wine list because I was helping them out with some stuff. And she goes, oh, the wine list is all natural now? And I was like, yeah. And then she goes, that's really unfortunate because I hate funky wines. And I was like, okay, well, let's talk about what you mean by funky.
Yeah, that's a pretty broad brush to paint
exactly.
The entire industry with.
Exactly. And so I asked her what she meant by that. Like, let's figure this out. And she was like, they just all taste funky. I don't know. I just don't know. And I was like, hold on, let me pour you something that it is not that. I know that you think that what you're talking about are faulted wines, like wines that have too much volatile acidity, too much Brettanomyces, too much of, you know, they're out of balance. Let me pour you this Mein Klang, like red wine that we're serving by the glass. And she ended up buying like 3 bottles of it, her and her friend.
Yeah.
So like there's that side of it. And then there's another side where the wine shop I hang out at a lot in LA, Psychic Wines, that opened last summer, you know, I was in there and someone recognized me and they were like, oh, I want like something really funky. Like, can you show me what? And I was like, well, what does that mean to you? And she's like, I don't know, you know, just like really cool and funky. And I was like, well, what kind of flavors do you like? You know, or do you like acidity? Do you like things that are
okay? Well, let me ask you this, because I do think if to some people, when they think of natural wines and they're saying funky, they think of some of those wines that have a certain barnyardy funk to them.
Exactly.
And that is a smell. And that, and I think that is a legitimate thing that some natural wines have much more than others.
Absolutely.
So what would you use to describe those types of wine?
I would just say barnyard.
Barnyard. Okay. You know, and that can smell that sort of like wet hay sort of smell.
That's caused by Brettanomyces, which is a bacteria.
Just throwing around the big words today.
I know. I can't help it. Well, we just call it Brett. But basically, that's just a wine that has a lot of Brett. And some wines do really great with Brett. You know, like there's certain red wines from the Loire that the Brett can bring out like really cool brambly, like blackberry notes and stuff like that. Since starting at Bon Appetit, it's been a real focus of mine, because I do focus on natural wines, to make sure that the wines I'm putting in the magazine are as well-balanced and as stable as possible. And that's not always easy, you know, when you're working with natural wines, because they don't have any preservatives in them. So sometimes, yeah, they can be out of whack. They can be out of balance.
But you know what? It's like, that's the same thing with any wine. Like, I see what you mean in terms of if something is not homogenized or this or that or processed, it's going to be a little bit more alive and you're not sure what you're going to get. But I think with any wine, unless you've had that bottle and that vintage before, you're never sure what you're going to get.
Absolutely.
We've all been to restaurants. It looks good on the menu. The sommelier talks it up. You get it. You're like, oh, like this is not really at all what
I expected.
Or it can
be something. Yeah. Or it can be. I mean, that happens to me where I have something in France that is incredible, but by the time it gets to California, it tastes completely different. Hmm. You know, it just, it's kind of a roll of the dice. And the thing with why I want people to stop using the word funky is that by describing the things you do or don't like with actual descriptor, like descriptives that mean something versus funky, which really is this vague thing now, then you can actually get something that you want.
Yeah, closer to what it is.
Exactly, because then it's like, okay, I don't like funky wines. Okay, I don't like barnyard. I don't want my wines to smell like barnyard, or like I don't want my wines to taste like kombucha. I don't want, you know, using real words of real things so that people can direct you in a better way and get a bottle that you're going to enjoy more.
Yeah, we always say, talking to Alex Grossman, our former creative director, and he would, in the world of design, he would say it would drive him crazy when people would say, oh, we just want it to look modern. And it's like, well, modern can mean 50 different things to 50 different people.
Absolutely.
You know, are we talking Bauhaus, or are we talking 1970s, or, you know, all sorts of
mid-century.
Yeah. So yeah, try to be specific. And I always think that's helpful when talking to a sommelier, is like, try to give them an example of something you do like, and something, can we find something that's close to that so-and-so wine.
Absolutely.
That you know you're into. Speaking of wines you're digging on, or crushing on, as you say in your new piece, wines of Central Europe, specifically Slovakia, Czech Republic, and Austria. I've drunk a lot of Austrian wine over the years. I don't think I've ever had anything from Slovakia or Czech Republic. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, so it's really cool. I just sort of got into these, and they're sort of now just making their way over here. The two that I really love, my favorite producer from the Czech Republic is Milan Nestrecht, and he does like just really cool, like very interesting wines. I think that he's taking varieties that we do actually know. Like, he has an incredible like Sauvignon Blanc that it tastes completely different because it's from this very small region.
What does that mean different? Because when I think of a French Sauvignon Blanc, a Sancerre Sauvignon Blanc, correct?
Oh, yes. I know. Your favorite word.
Sancerre. It has that sort of grassy, slightly crisp vibe.
Totally.
And I can smell it and I can taste it. How would this wine differ from that?
These wines have like a lot more fruit, I think a lot more forward fruit flavor notes on them. And like, I just think his white wines, they kind of just remind me of like tropical 1970s style, like tiki drinks almost, like with more acidity to them. And they're really exciting to me because they do have like some skin maceration. So they're a little weightier than like, let's say a Sancerre, you know, but they have these like great, great riper fruit notes, but they don't lean like ripe as in like, you know, like a big California super tropical bomb of Chardonnay kind of thing, you know?
I think they also have, when you see how do I pronounce it? Nestrecht. At the end.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a, never said the ch at the end.
Oftentimes it is, but the labels are very distinct.
Oh, yes.
Kind of like cartoon party labels going on.
Yeah, he has a lot of really cool labels. He has one that's just like covered with like the Queen of England, like just like little pictures of her face all over the place.
I think when you see it, you'll get it. Okay, so that's, and also with Slovakia.
Yeah, so this is, that's Strakov 1075, and that wine is named after the village that Zolt, the winemaker, is from. And I visited it in, wow, Slovakia is quite a place, I gotta say.
Quite a place.
It's quite a place. It feels like it's wild because it's like beautiful, but it's also like there's still like the speakers on all of the poles.
Oh, wow.
Like, so you're kind of like
Eastern Europe.
Yeah, you definitely feel like you've gone into another world. And it's cool because he's working with a lot of varieties that, you know, we just have never seen or heard of before because they're in Slovakia. And something that's really cool too about these wines is that I think that after, you know, like the Cold War and stuff, like the Iron Curtain situation with like the imports and exports, we weren't getting a lot of anything from this region. So,
but were the wines being made as much as they are now?
Yeah, the wines were being made, but they were just made for personal consumption.
Uh-huh.
Now, though, they're actually able to, you know, send them on out. And it's great. You know, Jenny Lefcourt, who's here in New York of Jenny and Francois Selections, her and her associate, Phil Sorrell, have been the ones that have kind of like pushed these wines. And I think it's great because going over there, there's so many people that are making wine there, and it's really cool to be able to explore a new region. And you know, because like I said, how many carbonic like reds from you know France can you really have before you're like, all right, let's try something new?
And the Slovakian wine, the Strekov, is called.
Yeah.
What in terms of grapes or varietals?
So a lot of them are actually I've found they just have these insane names. I'm not even going to try to pronounce them. They're bananas. But they'll be like, it's like Saint Laurent though, really, mm-hmm. which is another grape. He uses a bunch of stuff I do not.
How about this, red or white?
I love both of them. Uh-huh. His reds and his whites are really wonderful. I just had one while I was here. I had his Rosalia Pet Nat, which I'm not sure the grape on it off the top of my head, but I had it at, you know, the 10 Bells the other night, and it just is so fun and beautiful, this like really punchy rosé Pet Nat. And yeah.
So Slovakia, Czech Republic. So just when we see them on a wine list, they're worth checking out.
They're definitely worth checking out.
Different than what we've had before.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, they're still like in the natural style in terms of like their high acidity. They have a lot of minerality to them, like salinity. I know that minerality is kind of a vague word.
I get that. That kind of stony
taste.
Yeah,
exactly. You're like salty. Like there's like a salty quality to them, and they have great texture. Yeah. So it was really, I'm really excited actually about that region and what's going on there.
Okay, can we talk about wine glasses? Because I think for several years, back before I came to this job, I was like, there was this notion of like, let's make wine less pretentious, more fun. And
as we sit here drinking wine out of paper cups.
Well, that's because, that's all we have. But, and I remember at my previous job at GQ, I wrote some piece about just like, old Italian guys drinking wine out of the little juice glasses, and you've got your $12 bottle or your cheap rosé, and you're hanging outside in the summer on a card table. And like that made wine drinking fun. And I do think we had to sort of take down those barriers of like the Robert Parker ratings and Opus One and all that nonsense.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, wine should be fun. It should be enjoyable. It doesn't have to be expensive or pretentious. I've now gotten to a point where I'm like, okay, took that wall down. I'm like, I wouldn't mind some actual nice wine glasses in my cupboard, but I know I'm enough of a dingbat that if I buy the really nice ones, I'm going to break four of them in like the first 2 weeks. So what do you like in terms of nice, but not too nice?
I totally get what you're saying. And like you said, I'm on the same boat. Like, I don't think glassware really matters as much as some people think it does. I'm fine drinking out of a paper cup right now. Like, it's totally fine. But at the same time, you know, especially for me as a wine like professional, or I like to pretend that I am, I guess.
Do you have a card that says that? Marissa A.
I don't
Ross,
even have
wine
a card.
Professional?
I don't even have a card. I'm just like, I drink wine, whatever. You can find me on the internet.
But don't Google Marissa Ross?
You can actually, I think I've got that SEO down now.
Oh, okay.
The Marissa, right, nice. I used to have the A in there all the time because my SEO was not so good. But anyways, with the glassware, I got Zaltos as a wedding present. Now, Zaltos are like $60 a piece, like hand blown, like beautiful
super
glasses.
Slim
super
stems,
yeah,
light, beautifully balanced.
They're terrifying to drink out of. Like, I love them, they're beautiful, they're great, but
have you broken any of them?
Oh yeah, I have. I hit one against my couch and
your
it
couch
yeah and it shattered, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm not that strong. I'm pretty small.
Do you have a dust buster?
No, I don't. So
be good for that.
Yeah. But the Zaltos are really lovely, but they are really expensive, and I don't trust anyone with them.
Yeah.
Because like my friends, I adore them, but
not that much.
Yeah. No. Because I'm not gonna spend $60 a glass.
All right. What's a working man's Zalto? Or at least a nice employee, but not super rich.
Yeah. I guess I beat around the bush on that one a bit. I'm very into the Gabrielle Glass Glas. It's G-A-L-S, I believe, is like the last name
on
it.
And you can visit Gabriel, G-A-B-R-I-E-L dash G-L-A-S. Wow, international.com. That's a really long website URL.
Yeah.
But anyways,
but the glasses,
they're
really beautiful glasses. I'm really about universal glasses. Like, I don't think, I'm not into like using flutes for sparkling wine or changing glasses at all for red and whites and sparklings. So the universal Gabriel glass is awesome because it's $30. It's a little bit, it's still a nice glass, but it's a bit weightier. I feel more comfortable drinking it, drinking out of it. And it's, just feels a little bit better in your hand. Like, it's just like you can have fun. It feels like you can have
a little bit more fun. The entire time.
Yeah, I'm not like freaking out watching like a hawk. Everyone being like, "Where's the glass? Yeah. Like, where is it? Where is it? Like, who broke one? Who did it?" So those ones are like my new jam.
And it's kind of like it's a little bit wider at the bottom, then it tapers inward towards the top.
Yeah, just a bit.
Can we talk about vermouth? Our mutual friend Dave Rossoff in L.A.
Big I was like, my dad, Dave Ross?
Yeah. David Rossoff, Rossi, a.k.a. Rossi, opened a vermouth bar at some point a few years back. I feel like wine people are always trying to push vermouth on me as a thing. And I'm like, people in America just don't care about vermouth. I'm not saying we don't drink it in our martinis, but as like vermouth as a standalone drink. So can you sell me on it? Because I'm not there yet.
I'm happy to try to sell you on it. I think that this will go back to my maintaining that I like to do when I've started drinking. What I really, so the vermouth that we have in the issue is the Partido Jerez Muz, M-U-Z, and it's, I'm pretty sure it's a blend of a bunch of different red grapes, but I could be wrong on that, so I apologize.
Very distinct bottle.
Yeah.
Kind of bulbous with big M-U-Z painted on,
you
running
probably,
down vertically.
If you've, like, and they do make a ton of wine as well that have similar labels. So
where's it from?
It's from Catalonia.
Okay.
Outside of Barcelona.
So explain to me vermouth. Let's say I know nothing about vermouth. It's made from grapes.
It's made from grapes, yeah. It's basically fortified wine.
What does that mean?
So that means that they make it, it's like wine, but then they add grape liquor to it. So like usually like brandy.
Okay, higher alcohol content.
Yeah, so higher, but what's cool about this one, and a lot of natural winemakers are now starting to play around with vermouth. And what's cool about a lot of them is that the alcohol content is a bit lower. So I'm pretty sure that like the mousse is around.
You say it's generally between 15% and 18%.
Yeah,
so whereas a typical wine is more around, say, 12%.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so what I really like about this is like during the summer, especially this vermouth, like over sparkling, like with sparkling water and just some ice, like in the backyard, is just a great picnic for yourself.
See, that interests me. So you say three parts vermouth, one part sparkling water or tonic. Ice citrus wedge. I'm like, okay, I can get down with
that. Yeah, it's like, to me, it's like just like somewhere between a cocktail and wine. And I don't really drink a lot of liquor because
you're drinking wine all day.
Because I'm drinking wine, and because it affects me kind of way more. Like some gin will excuse my language, but it'll fuck me up. But I really do like cocktails. Like I like cocktails. I like the idea of it. Like
you like having a garnish.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to mix it up. You know, it's like I'm always drinking wine. It gets. You want to spice things up a little bit or just change things up. And I think
you want ice. You want ice in your glass.
Absolutely. But I'm not against putting ice in wine if you really need to do it. Like I'm not about no judgment. But what I like about this is that you can cool down with it. You don't necessarily get drunk on it. Like you can just have a nice afternoon cocktail and enjoy yourself and just chill out. Yeah.
Any noticeable difference if we're looking to buy some of these newish vermouths by natural winemakers between white vermouth and red vermouth?
I've only mostly seen red at this point.
Okay, interesting.
So yeah, and it's kind of a slow thing, but that's why it's in the September like preview issue. I'm hoping that we'll be seeing more of it.
Things that are starting to happen.
Yeah. Because it's I don't see a ton of it yet.
I'm gonna give vermouth another try when someone offers me some vermouth.
When I started here, you wouldn't even drink wine. And
I would drink wine, just not your natural wine. It was too funky for me.
Oh my, well, we've grown in leaps and bounds.
I know.
Because here we
baby
are.
Baby steps.
Yeah.
What are we at? We're actually drinking right now. It's 12:34 p.m. on a Wednesday
in New
York.
It's a little early.
I actually I've had this label, this brand, this maker
this
before.
Winemaker.
So can we talk about? Because I know, as with a lot of wines, especially in the natural wine world where we've gotten in spats about. Their labels are very distinct, the artwork on them, whereas sometimes if you go to Bordeaux or Burgundy, they're very traditional and they're sort of done in a certain way and you confuse one for the other. In the natural wine world, you're like, oh yeah, that I like that wine, even though I don't know where it's from or who makes it.
Totally, yeah. So right now we are drinking, the wine is by winemaker Baraccio. It's brought in by Tess Bryant Selections, which is in my new favorite importer of this year. She has an incredible Australian book, which is where Baraccio is. And yeah, so it's
not. She has an incredible Australian book.
Oh, yes. Sorry. That was some industry talk. When I say book, I mean that she, that's like her portfolio of wines. She brings in multiple really great Australian wines. But so today we're drinking, and I haven't had this one before, but we're having the Battered Salve, and it's 80% Chardonnay and 20% Sauvignon. I haven't had this before. I haven't had this particular.
Okay, listen. I'm just gonna this one simple man's description of this wine.
Okay, go for it.
I feel like I could serve this to Marlon, and he would think it's could be apple juice if I put it on ice with a little club soda in there. He would drink the whole thing.
It's really good,
and he would be acting like a maniac because that's how he acts most of the time, anyways.
Yeah,
but it's a very easy to drink summer wine, I would say. Is that fair enough?
I think that's super fair. It definitely sees some skin contact. It has it has a nice color to it, but it's not quite orange.
It has some tawniness to it. I would say it has a little bit of that sourness to it, but it's not, I wouldn't describe it as crisp.
No, definitely not. The acidity on it is, it's more wrapped up in these fruit notes, you know.
Yeah.
The 80% Chardonnay is definitely where that like kind of tropicalness is coming from, and the Sauvignon, I believe, is like what's bringing the acidity.
Is it fair to say that what most of us, I think, American wine drinkers associate with Chard is, you like that, Chard, that's what they call it, is the fact that it's aged in oak usually, and we kind of taste that oakiness from Napa or Sonoma or wherever, and that's what we think of when we think of Chardonnay?
Totally, yeah, I think that that's very fair. I mean, there was definitely a period in my early 20s where I was like, I hate Chardonnay, it's the worst. Like, I didn't realize that, you know.
It depends what you do with it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so much of it, and this is true for all varieties, you know, all wines, is that it really is in the hands of the winemaker and what they decide to do with it. So, and that's what's really cool about, you know, even Australia, they're doing a lot of really interesting, and Slovakia, and you know, they're just doing interesting things with these grapes that you may think that you know, but you actually don't, and you get to see a new expression of
them. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Speaking of Chardonnay, the dominant white grape in the Burgundy region of France, yes?
Yes, true.
How often when you're out do you just drink regular old-fashioned regular wine that's not natural, organic, or any of that? Like if I'm taking you to dinner, like, hey, let's get a nice bottle of French Burgundy Pinot Noir.
Not often.
Really? You're just like, well, what if you go to a restaurant and they don't have a natural wine
then
list?
I'm usually getting a Campari soda.
Would you literally won't drink, like if I get a nice bottle, let's say I get a nice bottle of Nuit Saint-Georges, like
is, you're gonna 2005
or whatever a good year in Burgundy was, or 2012, going to drink it?
It really,
that's just dumb.
I will try it. I wouldn't necessarily order that bottle for myself. If someone orders a bottle and someone says that they really like something and then they enjoy it, I will definitely try it. It depends on the producer. It depends on the winemaker, because there's certain conventional wines that are really well made. Like, I don't want it to be like, I don't want to say, like, you're kind of putting me in a position to look like an asshole. I think that there are plenty of really, really strong, incredible conventional wine producers.
Yes.
But a lot of those bottles are things, one, I can't afford, and two, like, I don't really have.
No, but I'm paying for it.
Yeah, if you're paying for it and you want to buy me like some baller ass bottle, like, sure, and of course I'm going to try it, I'm going to drink it. I might not drink the whole bottle of it like I can this, because this is 11% alcohol, and the conventional wine you probably are getting me is maybe like, is, you know, it could be a lot higher.
But I mean, hey, but if we got a nice light Burgundy, a red Burgundy, you'd be able to drink that.
I would, I love Burgundy, but that's also too, like, but those flavor profiles are already, I just prefer lighter styles of wine. There's a certain quality of freshness and aliveness in natural wines that you don't get in a lot of conventional wines. And that's what I really look for, because it's something, and, you know, this is me being like idealistic and a bit whimsical, but like for me, it's something that I can really feel. Like, I can just feel the difference in the wines. And so if you serve me a wine, whether it's conventional or natural, and I feel something from it, if it speaks to me, then I will drink it. But also too, I don't think a lot of wines speak to me. There's a lot of natural wines that also don't speak to me.
Yeah.
Like, there's also a lot of shitty natural wines.
Well, I think that's the thing about wine. We've talked about this before. Like, the world of wine is massive, and until you're drinking something, you just don't know. And a lot of times you have to drink a lot of different things to figure
Absolutely.
Out what it is you love.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, I discovered natural wine very early in my wine career. And it was what I decided to focus on very early on. So also too, like, I don't think I'm an authority to even be like, I couldn't tell you the great conventional winemakers to go and seek out, because that's not what I personally have focused my work on.
Speaking about what you like,
I love that this is all about what I like, except that he had to make sure just to like dig in a little bit.
In your article in the September issue of Bon Appetit, entitled Care to See Our Wine Checklist. That's a play on Care to See Our Wine List. You get it? But we say Care to See Our Wine Checklist.
Gotcha.
Little play on words.
I just saw the title of it today. I didn't actually know it. So
the final point is big is back. And you write, no one's calling it a comeback, but bolder wines are about to hit your table again. Chalk it up to juicy, you're going to have to explain this word, but glau glau wines going mainstream or to climate change, but either way, expect more wines with higher ABVs, alcohol by volumes, and riper fruit. These may not be the best for day drinking. A lot of day drinking talk going on.
I know.
But they're great
for— I guess it's because I am here day drinking.
Yeah, but it's for fall. So, but they're great for hearty meals and for tricking your dad into loving natural wine. So talk to us about what, in your mind, the conventional impression of big wines, what does that mean to most people, and what does this new iteration of big wines mean to you?
Totally. So when I'm thinking about big wines, I'm thinking, you know, Napa Cabernet, you know, Bordeaux, Barolo, these, like,
you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking Screaming Eagle.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never had Screaming Eagle, but I've read about it in Wine Spectator.
Exactly. It's like Opus One. Yes. You're like, obviously.
Big wines. Like guys like on Billions with the wine cellar.
Exactly, with the big glasses, yes. Like with the big Bordeaux glasses. Yeah, exactly. And I think that—
you know what I hate? I hate those wines. They put me to sleep. They just, like, I'm like, it's just too much. I don't need a 16% alcohol. Yeah. It's like, it's inky. It's like you're eating with like short ribs and pureed potatoes, and like halfway through the meal, my head's on the table.
Well, and that's kind of what really bothers me about like restaurants, is like they'll have like these really beautiful, delicate, like, menus and like dishes, and then they're trying to serve these like huge
yes.
wines.
And
I'm like,
these,
dude,
in these giant balloon like burgundy glasses, yeah, that can literally fit an entire bottle.
Exactly, I could fit in them. But so, like, going to, like, so you were like glue glue. So glue glue is basically
glue glue. All right, explain that, because that's a natural wine term that it's I don't a natural think the wine average term. Folk throws around.
Yeah, so basically glue glue is French for glug glug. They're really low alcohol wines, you know, like they're 11-12%, usually chilled reds, which we've talked a lot about over the last couple of years since I've been here at PA, because they're some of my faves. These glue glue wines, these like light, low ABV chilled reds, have become so popular.
A lot of these Gamays, for instance.
Yeah, totally.
Just,
yeah.
And you just throw them back.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's, or like even, glug glug glug, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So a lot of wine has kind of like become that, like that kind of became the trend within the natural wine world, right? So now there's producers that are kind of like pushing back against that and are kind of like, well, let's return to like some of these other styles. Like, we shouldn't be abandoning, you know, everything for just this one particular style. I think someone that's doing it really well is Nick Couture of Sonoma Mountain Winery. He's making these incredible like Merlots and Cabernets that in Sonoma that taste unlike any Merlot or Cabernet I've ever had. Like, I just had one of his Cabernets recently, and it had like this like very interesting like pine notes to it. And it was like, even though it was like almost 14% alcohol, you couldn't tell, because it was just like really well balanced. And so what's cool is that they're bigger wines, and they have these bigger flavor profiles, but you don't just taste the alcohol, because that's like my big thing.
Well, sometimes you can smell it, the wine almost feels hot.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
On your nostrils, like, woo.
Exactly. So it needs to be in balance. Like, that's really important. And then also too, so the climate change situation is that, you know, the world is just getting hotter.
Okay.
And
how does that affect wine growing?
So
grape growing.
Yeah. So when you're growing grapes, basically the warmer the climate, the more sugar the grapes produce. Mm. And so the more sugar they produce, the more alcohol content they have, because the way that wine, you know, in fermentation, the yeast and the sugar come together and then they make alcohol. So the higher the sugar content, but also too that just means that they're riper and bigger and hotter, yeah. Like literally hotter.
Do quote unquote big wines, are they typically more amenable to aging?
Yes and no.
I mean, you talk about like Barolos and big Napa wines, yeah. Like you can
I mean, yes, it's hard to say though, because it's like, I guess in kind of like a traditional sense, you would, yes, like traditionally, I think that I would say that that's correct. Because a lot of times it has to deal with like tannic structure and, you know, just, or that they just need time in bottle, but particularly in the natural wine world, you really don't know if something can age or not.
Because they're less stable.
Yeah, because they're less stable. And I mean, there is a big myth that you can't age natural wine, which is totally wrong. You can definitely age them. I mean,
but there's a difference between you can and what is typically done. Typically, it seems to me that natural wines are drunken.
Yeah.
More quote unquote fresh. That they're, yes, they're closer to the vintage that they are. Whereas a lot of times a Bordeaux, you can have a 40, 30 year old
Bordeaux.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a lot of times you can have a 30, 40 year old Bordeaux because of all the preservatives that's in it. Yeah. So I think that, but with the climate change thing, so basically also these winemakers are having to kind of, you know, they're having to make choices on or they actually sometimes don't have a choice in the matter. You know, mm-hmm. Like when I harvested in Italy in 2017, that was the hottest year that they had in 200 years.
Yeah.
They were,
I think things like that directly affect vintages, and it's why one vintage
absolutely
is different or better than another, and how much rain they get, all those things.
Makes a huge difference.
Have an impact on the taste of a wine for that year.
Absolutely. And that also affects like when the winemaker, you know, the winemakers have to be very particular about like when they're picking it, you know, like in Italy that year, they had to start harvesting in August, but it was also hard because a lot of people lost a ton of crop because of frost in hail that year. So, you know, these winemakers are having to deal with a lot of different changes that are happening in their regions. And a lot of them, the winemakers that I work with, these smaller producers, they have been making wine a certain way forever, you know, and they haven't had to deal with this stuff before. You know, it's like always kind of been the same. And now it's like the world is changing and their wines are going to have to change and their winemaking techniques are having to change along with them.
You're getting on a plane this afternoon back to L.A.?
Tonight. I had to change it. Yeah, I was supposed to fly out this afternoon, but then I had to change it because someone was in Canada.
Who was that? And you needed to do a podcast.
Yeah.
So when you're like on the plane and they come by and like, oh, would you like some Chardonnay or Merlot with your meal? What do you do?
Absolutely not.
So do you bring on your own?
No, don't do that. I found out that if you do that, it's like a $10,000 fine.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy because I know that everyone's like, oh, like you should like just.
I tried to do that coming back from France before. Like, oh, let's bring a little like cool sausages and cheese on, and we'll have a little picnic on the plane. And they're like, yeah, no, you can't.
Yeah,
do
no.
That.
So yeah, it's a fair. Just so everyone knows out there, it's a $10,000 fine if you open your own alcohol on a plane.
Unlike Andrew Knowlton, does this mean you never drink on a plane?
I usually what. No, that usually too, because I don't like flying. I generally will go with a gin and soda with lime.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Even though I said earlier that gin
makes you crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't make me crazy. I just said it kind of fucks me up if I'm drinking a lot of it. But I mean, out of all the liquors I drink, or you know, like if I'm coming back from a wine trip, sometimes like a really cheap beer is great.
Oh yeah.
Yesterday I had a Stella Artois.
Oh, wow. I've heard of that.
Yep, I had it. I drank it. Not only did I drink one, I drank two.
Oh, my God.
Because I was just like, I need a break from wine, and I just need like just something that's cold in this godforsaken.
Most people say, I need a break from wine, I'll just have like a club soda or a glass of water. I'll have a couple of beers.
No, because I was maintaining.
Oh, you were maintaining.
I had to maintain.
All right, folks. Do as Marissa A. Ross does and maintain this fall. Marissa, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Carla Music, question.
Ask me.
Growing up, were you one of those families at the dinner table where they would take the hot corn and roll it in the stick of butter?
In fact, no. And the first time that I saw that was in a movie, right? Isn't it in Breaking Bad? Not Breaking Bad, Breaking Away.
The The cycling movie.
The cycling movie.
One of the great film. A few youngsters out there have not seen it. A great,
incredible.
Great movie.
I watched it with my kids recently. It totally holds up. But wasn't it in there?
I have not seen that in a while. But I do know the first time I was at a friend's house and experienced it, I was at once like appalled and like incredibly intrigued.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
Like, wait, you can do that?
The first time I saw that, I was like, why has this secret been kept from me my whole life? Because we were a softened, unsalted butter kind of a household. So there
so
was
you would
always
leave the butter out?
The butter was out. The that butter was always out.
It kind of freaks me out.
I know it freaks people out, but I guess we went through the butter at such a clip that it didn't matter.
So it was so soft already.
It was already room temp. So you would take a pat with your knife, and then your corn was hot, and then you would slather. But then when I saw that rolling it right into the
stick,
oh my God.
Yeah.
And then there's another movie. Is it E.T.? What movie? Where they they butter a piece of bread and then roll the corn
like a little cozy blanket sort of thing.
Yeah. And that was like, whoa.
But that just makes no sense, because like if you're doing the bread, why not just put the butter on the corn?
I know. That's like next level.
That's just showing
shit.
Off. Do you want to talk about any other movies that came out like between 1979 and 82 or so?
Yeah.
Like Close Encounters or something?
Sure. We just watched Meatballs the night before my kids went to sleepaway. Also,
is that appropriate for kids?
It's like 80s inappropriate, which is really benign for these
days. Well, no, but there's like a lot of those movies where there's just like the random shower scene.
Oh, there's also all these scenes where Bill Murray is like groping without consent his like female counselor. And it's the kind of stuff that like you can't tackle a girl as like a come on. Like that's not cool.
I'm just going to change the subject to corn right now. Okay, corn season. It's August. Got to be all in at the moment. First of all, buying corn, if you can go to the farmer's market, what are you looking for when you're picking up ears?
The first thing that I'm looking for is all the people who are pulling the husks back so that I can like publicly shame them and tell them not to do that. So that's one thing. I think you want to look for, this is just my big rule with produce, just look at the stem end, man. The stem and the silks will tell you everything you need to know about the corn. So the stem should look like freshly broken off of the stalk, not dried out, fibrous and wrinkly or like overly trimmed. So it should look fresh at the stem end. And then the silks that are coming out the top should be nice and silky, like a beautiful, you know, like Upper East Side blonde, you know?
You're talking, you want Gwyneth Paltrow hair, not like mangy, like Woodstock hair. Like,
because
sometimes you see it and it's all brown and everything, and you're like, should I not buy this?
If the word mangy comes to mind, you want to skip it. And then the other thing the corn should still be cold, ideally. Like, I love the stands where they are sort of throughout the day going back into the back of the truck and pulling the cold, dark
cases of corn.
Because corn, you just want to keep corn cold from the minute it's picked until you eat it. It just preserves it better, and it slows down the rate in which the sugars turn to starch and all that stuff. So places where they replenish the corn, like as that pile goes down, they go back up again. And then for the husks, really green, not dried out, taut, shiny.
Yes.
And you can feel underneath if the kernels are, if there's gaps or if they're wrinkly, you can just run your finger over the husk.
Yeah. So, they should be fairly big, heavy, tight jackets. Gwyneth Paltrow hair.
Yeah, exactly.
GP. Okay, I like the sound of that. This is always an issue because we both have kids. I have an 11-year-old. You have a 15
and 9, yeah.
I think it is entirely the job of the children to husk the corn.
Yeah.
But how do they do that without making a complete mess?
You go outside.
Go outside. And with like, is there any technique involved with husking?
I was just saying the other day we were having corn. I was like, if you can't get the husks off in 3 tears, you're doing it wrong. So I used to, when I was a little kid, I would like peel one husk at a time, like plucking a daisy. She loves me not. Husking or shucking? You shuck oysters and you husk corn, or you shuck corn? Okay, so what I like to do when I'm shucking corn is go up to the top and like pull as much of the green husk and the silks like as possible, like a big wide swath.
Be aggressive.
Yeah. because otherwise you're peeling one and then one and then one.
So, which I get, and I like that big, like grab a handful and just pull it, pull it. But then you, once it's shucked, husked, whatever you're calling it, you still have all those silk that's kind of hanging out. And I never quite know how to get rid of that silk.
They're sort of annoying. They're like static cling. They like hang on to the kernels.
Did you see what Christina Che? So Christina Che, editor of front of the book stuff here and everything at BA, she Instagrammed yesterday. She had, what was the brush she had?
It's a Japanese like natural bristle vegetable brush, which I have those too. That's kind of like in a horseshoe shape. Yeah. And she said she basically dry brushed the ear of corn.
Which is something my wife does, where you're supposed to dry brush your skin to do
towards your heart.
Speaking of goop, GP's getting a lot of run on this show. So yeah, she brushed it and that removed all the silk.
She said they came right off.
So that's pretty cool.
I always, that's where you like, does slow you down. And then I'm impatient. So at a certain point, I'm just like, whatever. Any silks that are still left are like also coming to dinner.
Yeah, no one's going to die.
You're going to deal.
The only thing you do have to remove, and I had this the other weekend when cousin Tony was hanging out at our house. CT freaked out because there was like a little worm or whatever in the very tip. I'm like, well, that happens because that means it's being grown on a farm.
Right.
And you just cut off that tip. If the tip of the corn is a little mangy or rotted or whatever, just cut it off.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
And the rest is fine.
100%. Also, just really don't be that person who's like peeling back the... If you peel back the corn
at the market
and then you decide, like, for whatever reason, you're not pleased with that thing and you put the ear back, no one's going to buy that one.
Yeah.
That's like taking a bite out of an apple and putting it up in the bin.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd go that far, but I hear you.
But if you're like have a whole pile to choose from and then you're like, oh, I'll take the one that someone else clearly like rejected.
Yeah. I also think with buying corn, we talked about this with you and Gabe last month of the pod, like early in the season, like, good in-season corn should be big and heavy, and like I said, those tight husks. If you see corn that's kind of small and kind of the husks are kind of old, that means like it's coming from somewhere else. It's not ready yet. It's not ripe peak season corn. Just wait a few weeks.
Yeah,
we're gonna get to actual eating of food, but all right, cutting the kernels off. I disagree with the technique here. I don't disagree, but let's talk about the technique in the magazine this month's Bon Appetit.
Yeah, you disagreed strongly.
On Slack.
Also at a wall meeting.
Okay, this one definitely works. I just do it a different way. So talk about the way that we advise in the magazine in our August issue.
Okay, so like all things, we have described this in different ways over the years, but I think that the majority opinion these days is you shuck your corn and you put the cob down on the cutting board and then take your knife, zip down the side of it.
Lengthwise.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And just take off like a whole row of kernels and then roll it onto that flat side and zip them off again.
So
and
you
roll
now
it again.
Have flat sides to stabilize.
Correct. I have also done it where
can I give mine?
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to be like Ruth Bader Ginsburg with my dissenting opinion.
Point, counterpoint.
So I get that. I still think the first one, it could be a little wobbly, and having to do like the whole length of a long ear of corn could be kind of challenging to be doing like lengthwise. I like to take, because we're taking the kernels off, I like to take the corn, cut it in half, and then take that half of corn and put it vertically, flat side down on the cutting board, and then just go zhunk, 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 zhunk.
What I like about what you're describing is you create this really stable, flat base.
Yes, and you're going down.
And you're going down.
Which is a natural cutting motion.
And you've like made it shorter because if you tried to trim just the base and stand the
whole,
it could be wobbly. So the thing I don't like about that method is it's twice as much cutting, hypothetically.
Yeah, but
then
if you have a good knife, cutting's fine.
The top half and the bottom half. I think
true.
The long way, have you tried it?
It's no, not, of course not. I just criticize it. I haven't actually done it.
Okay, well, if you can like slice a miche in half or like a loaf of bread. I mean,
I can't believe you just throw in the word miche. Like that's like what normal Americans say.
Okay, but.
Let's just say a loaf of bread.
Just a loaf of bread.
Yes,
just,
a large loaf of bread.
They're not hard. It's not like you have to really struggle or push through. Like you just get the front of the blade in there and just zip down the side.
Hey, you do you.
But I used to do it where I stood it up on the stem without trimming the stem.
Oh,
and then
crazy.
It would be like all teeter totter. That doesn't work.
No, no.
And then I've also done it where I put a rimmed baking sheet with a small cutting board inside of that and then upended it and sliced down so that as the kernels fly off the sides and bounce, they would bounce into the rim sheet tray.
Don't
but then I started doing the sideways
do
thing.
Where someone has a large mixing bowl
yeah.
and puts a smaller mixing
yeah.
bowl upside down.
Yeah,
anyway.
It's just like crazy.
Okay, let's talk food because let's start with loose kernels. So you've de-kerneled your cob. We have lots of recipes that call for this. I don't know if we have one of this. I guess we do in BA. We haven't done it in a while, but I remember years ago I was on a work retreat, and at lunch there was a caterer there, and they made a corn pudding from Silver Palette.
Mm.
And it was so good with like fresh corn, lots of heavy cream, some sugar,
yeah.
and like
my mom
really
loves
naughty.
A corn pudding.
Oh, I was like, God, that was good. That was something I did not grow up with. And
yeah.
It was like a revelation for me. We do a lot of salads, though, at BA, right?
We do. We do a lot of, like, charred kernels, lightly sautéed, and then combined with other things.
And also fresh kernels. You can.
Yeah.
I like to do just take, if you have good ripe corn, that's fine to eat raw. And I don't think people will realize that. You can just take that, some lime juice, some, like, a shallot vinaigrette, a bunch of cilantro, maybe a little, like, hard cheese in there.
Yep.
And there's your corn salad.
Totally. We have one recipe that I really like that we recently updated. And it has, I feel like, lime juice and a chili and maybe a shallot.
Mm-hmm.
And you char like a third of the kernels.
I think it's mixed. It's part charred.
And then you
part,
add
yeah.
that back in. And that's nice just for like a little variation.
So check that. Yeah, corn salads, Bon Appetit, lots of recipes on the .com. Boiling corn, I mean, there's not real, it's not that hard. But the only thing, I find that most people boil corn too long.
Yeah.
If you have good fresh corn, you're basically just getting it hot.
Like I think steaming is the way to go.
Interesting.
So
how do you do that in terms of like space, like structurally?
Steamer basket and like, because they're vertical, you can just stand them up in
like
that
in a really
pot.
Deep stock pot.
Yeah, like one of those,
oh.
you know, the way you would do asparagus or
yeah.
anything. So that if you have the expandable basket style steamer, and then there's 5 minutes.
Yeah,
three
max.
Minutes,
yeah.
5 minutes.
You basically just want them hot. The only thing with steaming, and I guess this applies to sort of any vegetable as opposed to quickly boiling, is that you can do it in rapidly salted water.
Yes, you can.
So the salt then infuses the corn with flavor. Steaming,
totally.
You're not getting that.
No.
And then
true.
You got to make sure it's solid at the table before you roll it in the stick of butter.
For sure.
Okay. RBG here again. I'm dissenting with the way you guys grill your corn.
I did it last night.
And what did you do? Walk us through it.
So I don't think you need to shuck corn before you grill it. And I've done it all the ways. So I'm speaking from experience.
Yeah,
so
where are you at now? What are you digging?
What I'm digging right now is don't do anything. Take your corn that you got from the farmer's market, walk it out to your hot grill, put the corn over direct, medium, high, direct flame, and cook it, turning it, you know, roll it over onto its other side. 6 minutes, 8 minutes, I don't know. You want those husks to be nicely charred. So what's happening inside is that there's moisture in the husk, there's moisture in the silks. The corn itself has its own internal moisture. So as it's heating up, there's like a steaminess happening that's cooking the corn through, but also the direct flame that is also getting through all those layers of the husk will put a light char on your corn. And what it won't do is it won't get dried out or shrivelly or tough or chewy. Because it's insulated in there. So it's getting the benefit of the high heat, but also the protectiveness. And then when you go to shuck it, the silks literally fly off.
So it's like a corn steam room.
Exactly.
I bet Goop would endorse this. It's better for the corn.
But you
sort
do
of
get some light charring on the kernels.
Do you though?
Yeah, you do, because I did it last night. And my own son, I was like, oh, you got some light browning there, didn't you, little guy?
All right, so here's where I'm coming from. I would enjoy that. I'm not saying I wouldn't, but if you're doing like elote, the Mexican style corn, where you take the grilled corn, you slather a little mayo on there, then some cotija cheese, and you got your chili powder and everything, squeeze a lime juice. I like that where when the kernels themselves are somewhat charred mm-hmm. and browned mm-hmm. and they had that caramelization, that smokiness. And to do that, you've got to husk them first yes. and then throw them straight on the grill.
I'm not saying that's bad.
I think you are, though.
No, I'm just saying.
You use the words chewy and dried out.
Well, I think that's you run the risk when you put your naked corn cob on there and it's got direct heat. They cook really fast. So I think if you're paying attention, maybe there's a little bit. Do you put a little oil? Do you do any kind of fat?
I don't think I do, but I do think in order for them to not dry out, and I had done it before where they've gotten a little chewy and stuff, I think you do want really high heat so they don't have to spend that much time right. on the grill.
Yes.
It's almost like a steak. You want high temperature to get the outside seared and keep the inside yeah. medium rare. And same thing with corn. You want that nice char done quickly. Take it off.
Yeah. I think that's a good method if you're there. And I would rub a little bit of oil on yeah. it because that will help conduct the heat and get them to cook quickly without drying out. And then that's an active thing. You're paying attention. You're going to eat them right when they come off. You have to do a little bit of work up front to shuck them, right? The other method where you leave them in the husks and grill them, it's very forgiving. So I've done that like at block parties where I char everything and then kind of park the kernels, you know, in like a gas grill inside the lid. Sometimes there's like a
deck.
Basket where you can like, and you can let stuff kind of hang.
So the cobs hang out there still in their sleeping bags.
Yeah. And that way they stay warm and they're not going to dry out. So. Yeah. You know,
and then do you then, when you serve them, you let the diner take the husks off themselves?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes
right.
we pass like a brown shopping bag at the table. I know it's not classy.
No, I do like that because I had a few weeks ago, we bought some corn and we didn't grill it because on the grill, we had like one Weber and we were grilling this and that and we had like a bunch of stuff going on. So I was like, to Simone, I'm like, let's just boil it. So she had the pot of boiling water going. But the thing, what happened was we didn't have our timing in sync. Because you're dealing with live fire and something's taking too long to char. There's flame ups. You got to wait a second. So what happened was the good farm stand corn was sitting on the table just naked, boiled for 10 minutes before we actually sat down to dinner. So it had lost its heat.
Mm-hmm.
Still tasted great, but you didn't get that melty butter deliciousness.
And you like, still put butter on it, though, right?
Of course. But I do like that notion of like the grilled corn stays, it's insulated, so it stays hot in the husk.
So maybe it depends on your scenario. Maybe for a crowd, grilling in the husks has the benefit.
If you have room on your grill whatever else you're grilling. I think with anything with grilling, we've talked about this a lot, is just so much of it is timing and planning.
Totally.
It's like, how much grill space do I have? What's the timing on the various things I want to grill? Not everything come out hot at the same time.
No.
Oh, and one thing with elote, I'm all for like, you know, cheating and adjusting. Like if you don't have cotija cheese, I always think Parmesan works good.
Sure.
You know, so yeah. You just do something sort of sharp and salty.
Yeah.
It's a similar effect. Are you a person, we have on our one sheet page in the August issue, we have 4 compound butters.
I've
AKA,
seen them.
AKA flavored butters. Are you one to do that ever?
I'm not opposed to doing it. I have done it.
I like, it's very Martha 1990s in a good way, you know?
Yeah.
I like it, but am I going to soften the butter and then mix in the basil and the lemon and this and that? Like, I don't know. I mean, I would do it. This one, we have a few. We have like half cup finely chopped tender herbs, such as basil, lemon zest. You know, we have a harissa mint one. That sounds tasty. Parmesan with ground pepper and then a miso sesame butter.
You know how some people do like Bloody Mary bars?
Oh, yes.
Like if you were doing like a corn on the cob bar.
Oh, so you have different
flavors. That would be
flavors.
A nice array.
How cool would that be?
That would be good. That's a good party trick.
And you can either have them in little bowls or you can do that thing where you roll them in like saran wrap or whatever, put them in the fridge or freezer to get them hard, and then you slice them into little coins.
What if you made them into rectangular like butter stick shape and everybody could roll their own.
Roll your own. And on that note, Carla Music, thanks for joining us to talk about corn.
Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.